Hi, Sarah.
Hi, Allison. So unless you've been living under a rock or hiding in a cave, which, I mean, maybe you have,
I don't know.
you probably have noticed that AI, artificial intelligence, is a thing these days.
Of course. Yeah. Well, as journalists, it's already having a big impact on the way that we work. Mm-hmm. And as a mother, I have to say that I naively thought that my two teenage kids didn't know anything about ChatGPT until one day one of them produced a piece of homework in, I am not joking, 2 minutes.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Said I did it myself.
Yeah, mom. Sure.
Yeah. So it's there. And there seems to have been kind of a shift fairly recently and very quickly from this sort of dystopian vision of AI taking over and destroying the world to just, you know, accepting it's a thing, it's part of our lives, and actually now you can't afford not to be involved. And France, of course, is no different than this.
Yeah, so French President Emmanuel Macron hosted a major AI summit this week in Paris.
Yeah, co-hosted with India. There were tech companies there, world leaders. Here he is speaking in English to a group of Indian students during the summit. He's vaunting France's nuclear electricity generation capacity.
We can localize a lot of data centers on top of what we need in terms of electricity for our own companies, our own households. So it's very important in this world where I have a good friend in the other part of the ocean saying, drill, baby, drill. Here, there is no need to drill. It's just plug, baby, plug.
So the AI field is currently dominated by private U.S. tech firms, think ChatGPT from OpenAI or Google, and China. Macron and the EU are trying to position themselves as a kind of third approach to AI, with investments but also regulations.
Yeah, the EU last year approved an AI Act. That was the world's first set of rules to govern the technology.
Yeah, and the summit this week, a final statement called for inclusive and sustainable AI. The US and the UK didn't end up signing this statement. Macron said that while he would support easing some rules, you know, in order to encourage innovation, because some say it's the rules and regulations that are stalling innovation, he did say that regulation is needed to make sure that people embrace it and trust it. We need trustworthy AI, he said, or it'll be rejected.
So there are a lot of French companies involved in AI, aren't there?
Yeah, yeah. And some are making their own generative language models. This is the technology behind ChatGPT. One of them is Linagora. It's a company that's been around since 2000. And already at the time, pre-AI, was looking to create what General Manager Michel Modet said is a third alternative to, you know, software developed in the United States and in China. It's focused on open source, and it started working on AI in 2016. Just last month, it released a French language LLM, large language model, named Lucie, trained on content created in French and other European languages because, you know, for ChatGPT, for example, it was 99% trained on American content.
Salut Michel-Marie, comment vas-tu?
Salut, comment vas-tu?
Hello, I am doing well. Thank you for asking. How are you?
I'm fine. So I have probably some questions for you this morning.
I'm happy to answer any questions you may have. What's on your mind?
So we will raise the differences between commercial US language model and you. So can you probably try to explain what are the differences between these approaches?
The main difference between commercial language models in the US and me is that I am completely open source.
So Lucie is currently offline. It had a rough start. The company launched it without much internal testing, hoping to have the general public do it for them. Very few safeguards.
Yeah, but the problem is people got it to talk about, for example, cows laying eggs.
Yeah, they were messing around with it, and it really went downhill. Started talking like Hitler at some point, so they had to shut it down. A bit of a PR disaster. They pulled it, and now they're only having a limited group testing it, like ChatGPT did when it was first made public. But Modet is committed to this idea that is also being pushed by the EU of this third approach to AI between the super private, money-focused American way and the state-controlled Chinese approach. And he says it starts with language.
Languages are our culture, our civilization, our values. And we started to develop what we call Lucie, our large language model, to fix this underrepresentation of our culture, of our language, of our civilization.
ChatGPT can speak in French.
Yes, of course. But today, technologies are not neutral.
Explain, what is Lucy as a large language model that's different, say, than ChatGPT or what we know?
The main difference that our training data set has published in the same moment of the model. And our training data set cover and try to fix this this problem of underrepresentation of European culture. So we manage the French, by the way, English, because it's necessary, but we have Spanish, Dutch, German, and Italian.
But so what are we talking about? What is it? What has it been trained on?
So we want to have very trust content. So we exclude and we avoid to use social network contents. So we promote academics content, our own content from meetings. So it's a completely real open source model. If we want to build transparency and trust on AI system, you have to know where and how these models are built. And it's very huge because, for example, the model has been downloaded 5,000 times, but the training data set is more than 50,000.
So people are more interested or curious because maybe because it's rare to be able to get behind the curtain of one of these things, no?
Yeah, people are more interested by have a view on the data used to train the model than the model today. But because we are starting our journey, so it's not completely finished. We release very early this first model of Lucy just to collect more data, so we have feedback. Not so good.
Lucy got released and it kind of went off the rails a little bit.
We learn a lot. And the first point, I think it's the interest about this subject. This kind of technology is expected. We need this alternative in front of a Chinese or US company. And I think that probably we release early, but I think that it pushed a good discussion about our strategy, and now people are waiting for the next stage of Lucy. The question we have today related to these AI technologies is, we will continue to be only users, or we will be maker and creator of our own strategy and our own technology.
Can we meet Lucy?
Yes, we can try.
Salut, Michel-Marie.
Hi, Lucy. How do you think that you would answer a question differently than other large language models that aren't trained on French or European data?
Hello, I am Lucy, a large language model trained on a massive dataset of text and code in French and other European languages. This means I am able to understand and respond to questions in a way that is sensitive to the nuances of European culture and language. For example, I can provide more accurate and relevant answers to questions about European history, politics, and current events. I can also better understand and respond to questions that are phrased in a way that is specific to European culture.
Could you give me an example?
Of course. Let's say someone asks me, what is the best way to make a French onion soup? A model trained on a global dataset might give a generic recipe, perhaps one that is more common in America. However, because I was trained on French data, I would be able to provide a more authentic and nuanced recipe, perhaps one that is specific to a particular region of France. I might even be able to explain the history of the dish and its cultural significance.
What about broader questions, you know, like philosophical or sort of political questions? Like, how do you think that you have a different approach?
You are right. I am still learning and growing, but I believe my training on French and European data allows me to approach philosophical and political questions with a more nuanced and contextualized perspective. I can also better understand the nuances of European political discourse, which can be very different from that of other regions.
But I think that the most important, as she said, that it's a question of nuances.
Yeah, she did use that word nuance a lot.
But you know, these large language models are statistics. And if the model are trained mainly on US content, probably you have more chance to have answers influenced by US culture. So I think it's why it's important, because now we want to put these systems in our daily life. So I'm not sure that, you know, this is the same approach between US and our social system here in France, in Europe. For example, to manage medical things, it's not the same. So I think that we can manage as well, but same efficiency at the end of the day. but probably with a more ethical or a more responsible responsibility.
I can't help think, for example, Google, like search, the dominant search on the internet. I know that there were French alternatives of search engines, but yeah, they never really picked up. And they never quite work the same way. And so there's this feeling of like, yeah, we should go with the French technology, but it doesn't quite work as well. How do you address that kind of issue? I guess you're going to say we just need to make it work better.
But I think that it's a question of only technical people. Because before, if we are discussing about search engine, cloud technologies, okay, so we are discussing about what kind of technology we can use. In this field of AI, it's completely different because it will change completely our life, our education for our children. So, and I think that people say, okay, we don't really want to be dependent or to, you know, to have external culture or external, a way to perform these things. So
for you, it's the technology is different enough that it's going to push us towards a different way.
Probably. And it's why I think the debate we have around Lucy were very interesting, because I think it raised expectation of we want to have our own technology, our own strategy, our own, mastering of our digital future.
One thing that came to mind, though, there's a lot of, you talk about Europe, European culture, European history, but then I mean, if you're going to go into nuance and you're going to go into specificity, at the risk of going sort of nationalist, but like, is Europe a culture and a specificity that's, specific enough to give the nuance you're looking for? You've embarked on this European project. It's a decision you're making.
Yeah, I think it's a good question, because a big challenge for Europe is to act as one continent. AI models could ease this common vision of what we call Europe. But I think the most important, it's to, because I'm not sure that European people are completely agree with, the very, very central system wanted by the Chinese government. And US people are more afraid of what the new US president and Elon Musk, his ideology push. I think it's a scary time for European people. So I prefer to have one common and global approach for Europe. So probably we will be stronger and better if we are playing collectively and act as a unique continent and a unique entity.
I take it that you're probably a bit of an optimist in all of this. And you wrote a book, a series of short stories, actually, a fictionalized view of what machines and AI can do with humanity.
For AI, so we saw some movies, we read some books that describe not something very, very positive.
Dystopias.
Yes, dystopias. So, and it's why I wrote this book. I tried to explore what I call the sixth digital sense. And I think that technology can help humanity to be better and not to develop more and more intelligence, but also emotional communication.
Do you see France as a sort of more positive on technology or negative? I mean, on a policy level, sure, but maybe sort of in the culture, around. How do you see France as moving forward?
I think it's more easy for people to imagine the worst cases, to imagine better.
France in particular, maybe.
Yes. we are strong to imagine worse things. But, before to start to write this book, so I took the time to see if, people are starting to think in this way. But France, but not only, it's more difficult to imagine something positive, because it takes more time to explain and probably to get the proof that it's possible.
Dans les nuits d'orage, tu fais des drôles de rêves. Te voilà qui te lève pour courir sur la plage. Naturel.
So, Allison, 20 years ago this week, on February 11, 2005, France passed an ambitious accessibility law, committing to making public spaces accessible to people with disabilities, integrating disabled kids to school, boosting employment.
Yeah, so some things have improved over the last 20 years. You know, you'll find adapted toilets and lifts in public spaces and offices. There are special ramps to get your wheelchair onto buses, Braille, for example, in museums.
Yeah. But there's still a ways to go. The law really underestimated how much time and money this would all require. And, you know, the political will has been focused elsewhere sometimes. Disability was recognized in France in 1975. There was a commitment to inclusion. In 1990, discrimination became an offense. The 2005 law ingrained this concept that disabled people should have the same access to daily life as anyone else, to public spaces, housing, employment, healthcare, education. And that is yet to become a full reality for France's 12 million disabled people. They're the country's largest minority population. On Monday this week, disability rights groups organized a demonstration in Paris to mark the anniversary of the law. Our colleague Laurence Théo spoke to people there. It was a rainy day, but many people turned out anyway.
Je dirais qu'il y a des choses qui ont été faites, mais pas assez, notamment.
Some things have improved, but not enough, says Vincent, who uses a wheelchair. To get here, I had problems getting into the bus, the ramps were stuck, and it's raining. Catherine, who also uses a wheelchair, said the law has improved some things, but there are still a lot of inequalities.
Les bâtiments publics, les gens ont encore du mal à y aller, donc c'est pas normal. Les gens doivent pouvoir circuler comme ils veulent, quand ils veulent, où ils veulent.
Public buildings are still inaccessible, she says. People still have trouble, and that's not okay. People aren't able to go where they want, when they want. As for employment, when you're disabled, you're penalized. We didn't ask to be disabled, so at some point you have to say stop. They say we cost too much to society, but what does that even mean?
So the 2005 law set targets for accessibility, but I guess they haven't been met.
No. So the law gave public spaces 10 years to retrofit to accessibility norms. New housing was supposed to be 100% accessible to people with disabilities as of 2015. But by 2018, they reduced that requirement to 20% of housing. Reducing the ambitions. For the accessibility of public spaces and buildings, despite numerous extensions, much of the work hasn't been done yet.
The law also set targets for companies of 20 employees or more to have at least 6% of disabled people on their payroll.
Yeah. And while there has been a clear increase in the number of disabled people working in France, they're still twice as likely to be unemployed as able-bodied people. Employers really are hesitant to hire disabled people, and some companies even prefer to pay fines than address the issue. And a major part of the law was to allow for disabled children to attend public schools with support. In 2024, so last year, nearly 500,000 disabled students were enrolled in public schools, a major advance. Previously, they would either have not been in school at all or have been in sort of specialized facilities.
But the issue is, then, what kind of schooling are they getting?
Yeah, many students spend 6 hours or less a week actually in school, right? So they face a lack of adapted teaching and facilities that are adapted to their needs. There's a severe lack of trained teaching assistants for students with special needs, and they're severely underpaid. So it's really difficult to even recruit anybody. There's a debate now over what to do about this 2005 law. Do we need a new law or better apply the existing one? This, of course, is the perennial question for anything.
On a connu les colonies, l'anthropophage, l'économie, la félonie, la traite d'esclaves, la dette, le FMI, Bruno Jean-Marie. Si je cours, j'ai des raisons, les mêmes que les deux nègres maigres sous un avion.
Sarah, as you know, in your other motherland, the US of A, Donald Trump wants to get rid of automatic birthright citizenship.
Yeah, it was one of his campaign promises.
So currently, any child born on US soil automatically gets American nationality, regardless of whether their parents are American or not. Trump has said that the US is the only country in the world to have such a system, which I don't believe is true.
Yeah, well, a lot of things he says aren't true. Canada and Mexico, for a start, also have unrestricted jus soli, or literally soil right, the birthright citizenship.
Yeah. Some judges in the U.S. are already saying Trump's plan is blatantly unconstitutional, so we'll see. But he sees it as a surefire way of stopping immigration, the idea being that Loads of women are coming over the border from, for example, Mexico to give birth in the US.
Yeah, they've called them anchor babies to anchor the family there.
Interesting term. Well, yeah. Why are we talking about this? It's because we're hearing similar arguments from the far-right national rally here in France and from some more conservative right-wingers. Prime Minister François Bayrou is favourable to withdrawing birthright citizenship in the French overseas territory of Mayotte, which does have a significant number of undocumented migrant families. Last week, Parliament passed a draft bill proposed by the right-wing Republicans Party to halt birthright in Mayotte. The National Rally actually wants to go much further. It's calling for a referendum to scrap birthright citizenship altogether in France. The government is divided on the issue. You've got in the Interior and the Justice Ministers who are in favour of ending birthright citizenship in Mayotte and restricting it in mainland France. Other members of the government are saying this is not an issue.
Yeah, well, and also that France doesn't actually have automatic birthright citizenship. Mm. That was modified years ago.
Yeah, you can become French if you're born here to foreign parents, but not until you're 18. And you have to prove that you've lived here in France for at least 5 years since the age of 11.
Yeah, so that's far from automatic. And in the midst of this debate, Bayrou caused quite a stir when, in calling for a wider debate on immigration and French identity, he said there was a feeling in France of being submerged by immigration.
So that's language that is more commonly used by the anti-immigrant far right here in France and in many European countries. So it triggered many on the left. But some people do have the feeling that there may be an issue of being too many foreigners. So the question is, is there truth to that claim that France is being submerged? And would restricting or even scrapping birthright citizenship be the answer? I talked to Tania Rachaud, a researcher in European law who also works for an NGO that fights disinformation on migration issues. She says the figures do not support the claim that France is being swamped by foreigners.
If you look at the numbers, then it's hard to say that there is an overwhelming crowd of foreigners. The statistic, the numbers, they refer to foreigners as people that don't have French nationality, and it's 8% of the population. So it's complicated to say that it is overwhelming. And we have about 10% of immigrants, so it means a part of them obtained nationality in between. For instance, I'm considered as an immigrant because I was born in Germany, but I had both French and German nationality from the beginning. But however, I was born in a foreign country and now I live in France, so I'm considered as an immigrant in the 10% of the population.
What is the trend? Are the figures going up?
Well, they are going up, but not in a very important manner. They're going around 2% in the 10, 15 past years. There are about 300,000 first entrances every year. That's being stable.
And is this mainly immigration from outside of the EU?
In the 8% of foreigners, so non-French people, there are around 3.5 that are Europeans. So it leaves 4.5, some part that comes from Africa, but also other continents.
And how does France stand in relation to its neighbours?
So it is not the most welcoming country among Europe, among the world. There are countries that welcome more foreigners, Switzerland, for instance, or Germany, the United States, Turkey. But it's not about the numbers, the figures, really. It's about the feeling of considering that there are a lot of foreigners in France. But it's more complicated than on the scientific level to consider a feeling. We are in a world who is changing and where the scientific reality is not the foundation of political decision anymore. It's true in the United States, and unfortunately, it's also coming in France. We heard the Interior Minister also Retailleau saying in an interview a few weeks ago that he considers that the reality denies economic studies, so economic research on migration question. But then, who are we listening to? That's an important question, I think. And there are some studies about the feeling of French people on migration subject. One of them has been done by an NGO. It's called Destin Commun in French, but they are attached to More in Commons, who is also a British NGO. And they determined that around 60% of the French population does not have an opinion on migration subject, and that around 20% of French population are considering that it is an issue on the identity level, which is also a debate now, the French identity. But the truth is, those 20%, they speak more out loud. They are more on social networks. There's more media coverage on those people that have a strong opinion on the question, and not the 60% that do not have an opinion on this matter.
Yeah. So the Prime Minister, François Bayrou, has called for a very open debate about the issue of migration, about French identity. Does it make sense then to address these concerns if they're not really based on fact, but they're based on feeling?
It could be useful on some level to be sure that the reality of migration is better known, because nowadays when people talk about migration, they have probably a very limited idea of what it is. Probably they do not consider me as part of the immigration question. So I think it could be interesting to have a real deep debate, but mostly in order to make sure that people have this really bright understanding of what immigration or migration is. On the other hand, it feels like this debate on migration has taken already too much space. We just got out of the last immigration law that was adopted in January 2024. It's only been a year. So it sounds like the only possible debate is about migration all the time, and that there is nothing more to say on the political level. And there are other subjects that would need to be debated in France, such as education, for instance, which also impacts a lot of more people than immigration and has less media coverage and political speech. So I don't know. It really depends on the way it will be treated. If it's a referendum, so if it's a question that has been asked to French people, I'm not sure it will be helpful.
The far-right National Rally, they want a referendum, for example, on the issue of birthright citizenship. Is it easy to get?
So birthright in France is not really easy to get. There's a sort of misunderstanding where people think if you are born in France, then you become French. It's not the case. It's more a long track possibility for someone who remained in France.
So it exists, but with conditions. The rules, however, regarding birthright are already a little bit different in the Overseas Department of Mayotte in the Indian Ocean. And already there was a change, wasn't there, to birthright in 2018. So can you just explain that a bit more clearly to us?
It relies on this misunderstanding that there are a lot of women from the Comores who are coming in Mayotte in order to have a baby and to be able to have a resident permit through that baby who was born. So this is already misleading, because it's not true. That baby won't have the nationality immediately. He or she will have to wait until he's 16 at least. So it's relying on a misleading ID. And in 2018, indeed, there was already a modification of the legislation specifically for Mayotte. So one of the parents at least has to be on a legal status already. They cannot be both undocumented, and that they had to be resident for 3 months before the kid was born.
And now there is a draft bill which has been approved by Parliament to try and stop birthright citizenship altogether in Mayotte. Is it possible to actually remove birthright from a part of France?
In general, birthright is the competence of the legislator, so it's possible to modify it in general. But indeed, there is the question of disrupt of equality between citizens, wherever they are, overseas or in the metropolitan soil. So that most likely will be against the constitutional principle. But on the other hand, in the constitution, there is also the possibility to have specific laws for overseas territories such as Mayotte. But I think erasing totally the birthright in Mayotte will go too far to be possible.
And what do we know about the link between having made it harder to get birthright citizenship in Mayotte. And then the number of undocumented migrants coming over from, for example, the Comoros. In other words, has that 2018 reform been effective in terms of cutting down on immigration?
Well, in general, research has proven that the migration policy of the welcoming country has no impact on the departure of people. The issue always lies on the country of departure. You leave your country because there is a problem in your country, and you don't leave your country because there are some specific possibility in the country that you are going to. That is applicable to all countries. But in Mayotte, the circumstances are very specific because it used to be same country, Comores and Mayotte.
Until 1974, yeah, when Comores decided to take independence from France.
Exactly. So there used to be more fluidity between those islands. Now the attraction to France is not relying only on the laws that are applicable or that may help people to obtain a resident permit or nationality, but it's more about the way people live in the Comores in general and the way they have a relation with Mayotte. So most likely, changing the birthright won't change the immigration situation on this island.
Sarah, there's some interesting official data backing up what Tania Rachaud was just saying there. In 2018, when the birthright citizenship regulations were tightened up in Mayotte, the number of children who got French nationality went down from more than 2,800 in 2018 to 799 in 2022.
That's a lot.
Yeah, that's a lot. So the authorities can say, hey, you know, we did a good job. However, there has been no corresponding drop in the number of undocumented migrants in Mayotte. On the contrary, the numbers have gone up. They now make up more than a third of the archipelago's population. That's it for the show. Spotlight on France is a production of Radio France International, and this episode was mixed by Vincent Pocha.
If you want to send us a message, write to us at spotlight.france@rfi.fr. If you like the show and you're listening to us on Apple Podcasts or Spotify, please consider giving us a rating or a review. It does help get the word out about the show.
You can also find photos and videos on the stories that we've covered on our Instagram page, Spotlight on France. We're taking a little winter break now, and we'll be back in mid-March. Until then, why not check out some previous episodes on rfienglish.com. Bye-bye, Sarah.
Bye, Alison. Bye.